Peter Weinberger, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
So as a senior program officer at the U.S. Institute of Peace, much of your work focuses on ethnic, religious conflict, divided societies, how to rebuild societies in post-conflict spaces. What, first of all, kind of drew you to work on issues of violence and conflict, and what are some of the most striking things that you really deal with in that area?
My focus at the USIP Academy is on working with religious, ethnic, and tribal groups when rebuilding countries after war and conflict. A lot of people who work in a post-conflict environment will say things like, I'm a specialist on rule of law, for example, writing constitutions, or I'm actually an expert on something, a functional thing, like training police forces, for example, or, in other words, might be working on rebuilding the physical infrastructure of a country after war and conflict. And often I'm told things like, I don't really care about these what we call identity-based differences, religious, ethnic, or tribal differences. I have a real specific task. That's not really part of my job. And what I always try to convey to my students is, I'm not expecting you to become an expert in this subject, but you have to understand that in countries that are what we call divided societies, where these aspects of identity are really salient and are what are causing a lot of conflict between people, we have to be aware that it affects all aspects of rebuilding countries after war and conflict, what is broadly known as peace building. I got into this particular field, which is sort of conflict resolution and applied peace work, after having worked on the ground in a few places like Israel and the Palestinian territories, Bosnia in the Western Balkans, Northern Ireland. And I had noticed a lot of commonalities between these countries, which were very different in terms of religion, identity, ethnicity. But I started to notice broad threads that were linking them. And that drew me to the work of the United States Institute of Peace, which is really perhaps the most respected in the world for this kind of applied work. And when I found out that the Institute was going to start a school for professionals, I decided to leave my last position, which was as a professor, and take on this new aspect of teaching.
So when you talk about the commonalities that you noticed in some of these very diverse locations, what are some of those commonalities? What are some of the primary obstacles, I guess, to resolving conflict or to reconciling divided societies in a post-conflict space?
Well, there are no modular solutions or what we call cookie-cutter approaches. And an analogy that I like to sometimes talk about is if you went to a doctor, a medical professional, and she or he told you, I do the same thing with each patient, I think most people would be running for the door. But at the same time, if you met a doctor and she or he told you, you know, I have a lot of experience, I've worked a lot of patients, and that's a good thing. So, you know, one can never really overly generalize about countries and cultures, which are vastly different, but one can try. So one of the things that we focus on are things like trauma. When we talk about trauma here in the United States, people are familiar with things like PTSD, post-traumatic stress. But in a lot of the countries that I am working on and my colleagues are working on, we're dealing with what we call intergenerational trauma. We've seen this to some extent in countries like the United States. If we're looking at marginalized communities, for example, ethnic minority communities. But in these societies, in a global setting, it's slightly different. If people have survived ethnic cleansing or attempts to exterminate them through genocide, this does not simply go away after the initial act has come to cessation. And it manifests over the second and third generations and all sorts of collective fears of the other community, for example, and fear of annihilation. And so if you look at a lot of countries in the world where there's protracted conflict, this is often the case. So you have intergenerational trauma, and it often occurs in more than one community. Another thing that we see are what we might call overlapping or parallel realities or parallel narratives. Most people understand the word narrative to mean a story. Or, for example, if you apply for a job, they might say, give us a narrative statement talking about yourself. But here when we talk about narratives, we're really talking about a people's fundamental worldview, a kind of understanding of how reality has unfolded. And that can relate to a trauma. But what we see in a lot of divided societies is that you have two peoples with completely parallel realities and parallel narratives. So there is a core disagreement about some event that may have occurred 65 years ago or 100 years ago or 300 years ago. And this core disagreement really filters into everyday life. So people can't agree what happened about the main reason they have conflict, and this affects something that happened a day ago or a week ago or 3 weeks ago. As an outsider who are trying to help, it can be confusing and be difficult because it's difficult to tell what has actually happened and what is happening. If you think of two circles that are overlapping and sort of one circle is one group of people's worldview and another circle is the others, where they overlap, there's a commonality. So if I was, for example, a counselor, a marriage counselor, and two spouses came and they told me two different views, two different stories of what happened, where they overlap is the commonality, and I can build on that to try to build trust. The problem or the issue that we face is there's often no overlap. So the role of those of us who are involved in what we call peace building is to try to create an overlap, to create some shared experiences. If people's core identities are so divergent, then we often try to build a secondary identity. That could be an identity as parents, as women, as for example, as grieving members of family, as professionals, for example, teachers, environmental engineers, and to use those secondary identities to build what we might call zones of agreement or areas of cooperation to slowly begin the path of reconstruction, not only physical reconstruction, but what's called social reconstruction, which is much harder and much more difficult.
So on that note about social reconstruction, so peace building is obviously goes well beyond ending the violence and rebuilding society physically, let's say, and engaging in, let's say, police training and establishing institutions for good governance. But it is a process by which we encourage and facilitate truth-telling, forgiveness, reconciliation. Are those the kinds of things that that you refer to when you talk about building trust and social reconstruction?
Those are definitely a part of the process, but it is layered and exceedingly complex. For example, sometimes we can talk about functional trust, meaning that two communities may agree to cooperate over issues of infrastructure, sharing electricity, for example, clean water, because there's no alternative. At the same time, they can come to no agreement on a shared educational curriculum beyond some things like math and science because they don't agree on history. When we're talking about issues of reconciliation, that's also something that we have to be careful about, the language that we use. The field of conflict resolution is not a neutral field in the sense that a lot of the ideas are influenced by Western philosophy and religious traditions, particularly Christianity. And when we talk about reconciliation, for example, this has, even amongst practitioners of international affairs who may be themselves secular, are not aware that this has some Christian overtones. And so if we're talking about truth and reconciliation, for example, in many societies, this is understood differently. That's not to say that they don't have these values in a Buddhist majority or a Muslim majority setting, but they understand it differently. I have colleagues who work on rule of law issues, for example, helping to write constitutions and come up with new legal structures after war and conflict. And they faced a situation where they discussed a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Nepal, which is a country in South Asia, and had civil conflict for many years. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is an idea that was adopted in South Africa after the end of apartheid in 1994. It's the idea that you have an informal or a formal, in some instances, a tribunal of respected individuals who listen to people discuss about crimes that were committed during the course of a conflict. And in so doing, they may receive a pardon or a reduced sentence. The idea by talking about what they've done is to get everything out on the table and allows the country to heal. It's a good idea in practice, but when my colleagues suggested it in the context of Nepal, they were told, why should we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission? We're a Hindu majority country. Our culture and religious ideas are based in Hinduism. We believe in karma. We don't believe in reconciliation. This is a Christian idea. So we were able to help them. It was about reframing what was done to fit the local people's cultural understanding. But the point is, it's not simply a rebranding issue in terms of coming up with a new name. It is about working with local partners who want your help, but also making sure that local resources and actual functional resources working on the ground, but also people's culture and identity are understood and are part and parcel of the process of healing.
So could you share with us some examples of successful peace building? I mean, just the places you mentioned that you've been doing work, Israel-Palestine, Bosnia, Northern Ireland. Israel-Palestine, I don't know that we would put that in the success category, would we? But what about Bosnia? What about Northern Ireland? Are these successful cases of peace building?
It has to be success with an asterisk, in the sense that there may not have been violence for many years, but there was a prolonged conflict. There continues in some instances to be intergenerational trauma. And many people don't necessarily believe that the country is operating in what we would call a healthy way. Normal is, of course, a relative term. But for example, I have been in Northern Ireland and in the capital city, Belfast. It's still largely segregated by sectarian or religious identity. And I've been told by people, for example, I don't want to live with the other people. I don't want my children to go to school with the other people. But I don't think we should go back to the way it was in the past. And I think our leaders should continue to negotiate with their leaders. I'll never agree with their narrative. They don't use that term, but that's essentially what they're saying. I'll never agree with their view of the world, but I don't feel threatened by it anymore. This, in some sense, is moving forward. It creates new problems. It creates new difficulties, but it makes an opportunity space whereby communities can try to find new ways to move forward.
Well, Dr. Weinberger, obviously peace building will remain a challenge, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. But we thank you for joining us on Worldviews to talk about some of the possible strategies. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.